Boa tarde, caros colegas que estão presentes nesta semana que sei que é uma semana particularmente difícil, em que todos têm responsabilidades um pouco por todo o país no quadro da campanha eleitoral em curso e numa semana em que não há trabalhos parlamentares. Eu gostaria de agradecer a presença do Sr. Pier Carlo Padoan connosco, na sequência de um convite que foi feito a quando do seminário parlamentar da OCDE, realizado no início deste ano, em Paris, quando a OCDE estava a desenvolver exatamente os trabalhos preparatórios do relatório sobre a situação da economia portuguesa e sobre as reformas de Estado conducentes à promoção do crescimento económico em Portugal. O Sr. Pier Carlo Padoan é secretário-geral adjunto da OCDE e é chief economist, foi professor de economia em conhecidas universidades, quer italianas, quer internacionais. Foi conselheiro económico de dois dos primeiros ministros italianos, do Sr. Massimo D'Alema e do Sr. Giuliano D'Amato. Exerceu funções no Fundo Monetário Internacional durante vários anos, acompanhando, entre outros, a situação de Portugal no Fundo Monetário Internacional. E exerce as funções de secretário-geral adjunto da OCDE, julgo que desde 2007. O ponto de partida para este nosso encontro de hoje é o relatório da OCDE. Esta é a sala onde reúne habitualmente a Comissão de Negócios Estrangeiros da Assembleia da República e é também a sala onde costumam ser recebidos os representantes da chamada Troika. É nesta sala que os representantes, os chefes de missão do FMI, da Comissão Europeia e do Banco Central Europeu têm encontros regulares. O último decorreu há uma semana atrás, com os representantes dos vários partidos no Parlamento Português. A expectativa que temos sob a abordagem da OCDE é que, sem pôr em causa aquilo que é a relevância de uma análise centrada em prazos mais curtos, a OCDE nos possa dar uma visão, olhando muito para aquilo que são as perspectivas da economia portuguesa no médio prazo e no longo prazo, e atendendo a fatores substantivos e qualitativos em domínios como a educação, a saúde, as qualificações que têm neste relatório uma importância significativa. Eu agradeço e refiro a presença, quer do Sr. Embaixador de Portugal junto ao CDE, Dr. Paulo Viseu Pinheiro, quer também, esta era uma reunião aberta, mas permitam-me que saliente também a presença da colega Antónia Almeida Santos, Presidente da Comissão Parlamentar de Saúde. Eu dava a palavra ao Sr. Pier Carlo Padoan, e depois abrimos um período de debate. Temos aqui uma limitação que eu esclarecemos desde já. O Sr. Padoan tem às 16h30 um encontro com o Sr. Primeiro-Ministro. É perto, mas de qualquer modo significará que, em termos úteis, teremos tempo até 16h20, 16h25 para este nosso encontro. Tem a palavra.
Thank you very much for your kind words of invitation. Members of Parliament, ladies and gentlemen, it is a great pleasure and honor to be here. The opportunity, and let me thank once again Ambassador to the OECD, who has been very instrumental in organizing this mission in this beautiful city I've been to many times in my life, and it's a pleasure to be here. Also, thank you for the weather, which is very appropriate. The specific purpose of my visit today is to discuss with you This report, I brought a few copies. I see that you have copies already, but just in case you want a colored version, it's there. I'll leave them with you. This is a report which was especially made for Portugal, and it is not the standard economic survey of a country. This is a report which brings together contributions from several directorates in the OECD, trying to provide a so-called whole of government view of what are the challenges of Portugal in this specific case, but also in other countries. So I would like to suggest that this report should be read in the following sense. Of course, Portugal is undergoing a very deep structural adjustment in the fiscal domain, in the structural domain. And in our view, this is beginning to bear fruits. We are seeing signs of better economic performance. We expect, like others, 2014 to be seeing a return to positive growth in the country. We are seeing adjustment in the current account. We are seeing adjustment in the fiscal domain. We are seeing slowly recovery coming against the background of a slowly but hopefully firmly improving euro area, which of course will be extremely important for this country as well as others. So there is a macroeconomic improvement which, and this is my basic message, must be banked on, must be exploited to address the underlying fundamental structural problems that Portugal is facing. Of course, Portugal has already done a lot in the structural domain, in labor markets, in taxation. We think more needs to be done in ways that would eventually enhance investment opportunities, and therefore, if investment picks up, this is the first element which suggests that the recovery will become more sustainable. I will therefore spend most of my time looking at the more medium-term aspects, having this macroeconomic background as a reminder. But again, as I said, we see positive signs in terms of adjustment, in terms of competitiveness, in terms of confidence, and these are, in our view, indirect signs that the adjustment in this country is not just related to the cyclical situation, but is beginning to be dependent upon structural improvements. And this is one element which may sometimes may be forgotten, but in our view has to be taken up extremely seriously. So the question I really want, the issues I really want to discuss with you is, what are the areas, according to our view and summarized in this report, that needs to be addressed more forcefully to transform this cyclical improvement into more sustained, structural, sustainable growth in the medium to long term? Well, first of all, we think that progress has been made in labor market reforms. I will come back to that, what we think more needs to be done. More progress is needed in product markets, meaning that more competition, we think, is appropriate for a country like Portugal. And I'm saying this not because of Portugal, but because of the strong evidence we have collected across a broad spectrum of countries that points to the fact that in the long term, output benefits are mostly driven by increasing competition in product markets. So this is an area where we think that benefits could be seen in terms of investment opportunities and therefore job creation. This again rests on evidence coming from our countries and an extended analysis of the potential growth benefits that members of the euro area as a group could obtain. So my first point, more competition in product markets. Related to this is more competition in network industries, which of course are important on their own sake, but also they represent fundamental factors determining the cost of doing business in an economy. And again, we think that there are margins for improvement in the Portuguese economy here. The other key element which requires a lot of attention is innovation. Innovation in a broad sense. You are probably familiar with the fact that the OECD has, since a number of years, developed what we call the innovation strategy, meaning asking the question, what needs to be done in a country to bolster innovation activities? And of course, innovation related, directly related items such as R&D spending or tax benefits for R&D investment are important, but they're only part of the story, number one. Number two, when we talk about innovation, we should remind ourselves that innovation is not just about inventing new products and putting them on the markets, but also changing the ways in which products are made, so-called process innovation. I'm saying this because this is done mostly through the availability of higher skills, human capital. And this is another area where we think progress can be made in Portugal. Third point, we are looking around the world, both in the OECD and in non-OECD countries, asking a question, what will raise long-term growth in advanced economies? And what we're beginning to see from evidence is that the most powerful source of productivity growth is what we call investment in intangibles, in knowledge, where by that we mean a broad set of factors that, however, are increasingly important in driving productivity. So innovation is about process and products. Innovation is about combining different policies. Innovation is about looking at intangible assets. But basically, innovation is about having companies innovate. The state itself alone cannot boost innovation if this is not picked up by companies. Why am I saying this? Because here there is one important complementarity in the reform agenda. Innovation-related reforms and measures must be inserted in an environment in which companies invest more, in which there is more competition. So you see that if there is product market competition and innovation-related measures, the incentives to invest are stronger. Here is an area where we think, again, this is summarized in the report, and I'm just pointing at issues that you may want to pick up later. This is an area where I think Portugal can make an improvement, and where, by the way, an important element can be addressed differently. And this is to what extent Portugal offers an interesting environment for talented skills, and including young people. This is a problem that I know, and you know, of course, very well, Portugal is facing. It's not just Portugal, it's a number of countries in some parts of the euro area, which is that we're facing the drama of not having enough jobs for talent, for skills, so skills go away, and this paradoxically aggravates the prospects of employment for future generations because it lowers potential growth, it lowers the potential for employment in the future. So if you have a conducive environment of innovation and investment, this by itself makes it more interesting for skills that could find a job abroad in remaining in the country. So this is my first point to reiterate is that there is a lot of scope for improving the effectiveness of specifically related innovation measures such as R&D and tax policies, but this has to be complemented by policies that are business friendly in a more general sense. And this, of course, also speaks to the other point I will come to, which is making the government and the state work better. innovation-related reforms, like all reforms, need to be approved, but then they need to be implemented. And more and more analysis and empirical evidence points to the fact that the final benefits of structural measures are in large part related to how the new laws are designed, but also very largely related to how they are implemented, which means that in the case of innovation, but also in other cases, the monitoring of reforms is just as essential as the introduction of reforms, which itself implies something else, that there needs to be time for reforms to bear fruits and to adjust reforms on the ground, so to speak, to make them work better. Why am I saying this? Because there is something that I hear very often in the policy debate, which says, oh yes, structural reforms are good, but they take long time to materialize, and therefore we cannot have the luxury of dedicating efforts, political capital, and resources to reforms that are too far away in the future. Well, let me say that our evidence about the timing of reform impacts is not so pessimistic. Reforms should not be seen as something that you put in place one day, you go to sleep, and then you wake up, say, 7 years, and you say, oh, this is what the reforms have done, the world has changed. Reforms build in slowly in the economy, but then they build in with increasing strength, with increasing impact. And therefore, it is important that once reforms are introduced in a system, they are monitored, adjusted in their implementation phase. And therefore, having a strong government and strong public administration, a strong state, is important not just to introduce reforms, but even more importantly, in implementing reforms. I said something about employment. Again, Portugal has introduced measures to reform the labor market, but more needs to be done. You all are familiar with the characteristics of the labor market in this country. For instance, there is still a very strong dualism in labor market. This is not just a Portuguese feature, of course. It is so in many European countries. And the problem with dual labor markets is that they have two negative impacts. One is about efficiency. At the end of the day, the economy works less well. It goes at a slower speed. But then they are also a source of inequality, which is something that we, and I'm sure you agree with this, we need to look at more and more when we design reform packages, when we design fiscal policy packages, and so forth. In our view, the recent reforms that have been introduced in Portugal have brought employment protection legislation closer to OECD average, which we take as a benchmark. So this is a sign of progress, and this has been achieved in a relatively short period of time. So this is something that should be bear in mind. But we think that to tackle unemployment and dualism, more needs to be done. For instance, there are measures that can be introduced in terms of supporting firm-level wage bargaining, which we find, according to our evidence, in a way to improve productivity and increase take-home pay by workers according to their productivity, and also increasing the incentives of companies to introduce innovation in the firm. On the fiscal side, reduction of the labor tax wedge would help. Of course, this has to do with the budget constraints, but this has to do with the fact that any fiscal consolidation, as let me remind an obvious fact, has two dimensions. First of all, the speed at which budget is adjusted, and secondly, the composition through which that budget adjustment is obtained. This second point in particular is something that we think at the OECD should be given more attention in designing and implementing adjustment. And there are ways through which a given amount of fiscal consolidation can produce better results in terms of employment creation, in terms of growth, and in terms of equity. So I may come back to this if you wish, but there is this in an area where I think more can be done in the country. Finally, in terms of policies related to employment, we would like to stress the important role of activation, meaning how do we, in practice, match demand and supply of skills. People have skills. They do not know whether their skills are useful to a company. Companies are looking for skills, and they do not know whether they can find those skills in the market. So there is a need of introducing activation policies, which, again, evidence suggests that they produce important results in terms of accelerating employment creation. Of course, again, this has a cost. And so when looking at the budget constraint, choices have to be made. But given the situation, we think that activation policies directed especially at the youth, who are the ones that are suffering most in terms of unemployment, should be given priority. And at the same time, measures could be targeted even more precisely at addressing the so-called NEET, the NEET, those people who are young people, who are neither in employment, nor in education, nor in training. So they are not working and not doing anything else, which of course is a very high source of concern in Portugal, but also in many other countries. Another part of the report looks at what in OECD jargon we would call skill strategy. How should the education system in a country be adjusted to generate those skills that in the future are at the same time most rewarding for the individual and at the same time most useful to the country in terms of growth? This is a very complicated issue where we are beginning to see some results and coming with policy prescriptions. Again, this is discussed in the report. There are a few basic principles which I'd like to share with you. First of all, there is an important role in evaluation. Again, this is the specific case of a general point that I made, the fact that evaluation is extremely important in assessing whether new measures are effective or not. So any education system should be a reform should be accompanied by an evaluation of what the results are. When we talk of skills strategy, of course, we are talking about the education system, but we're also talking about the role that the ultimate demanders of skills, that is to say the employers, the companies, can play in suggesting what their future needs are. And this means that employers should be involved in updating vocational and educational training. This, again, is related to what I was saying earlier on about the fact that it is essential to allow companies to be operating in the best possible environment. After all, think of this obvious fact. If companies want to innovate, they need new skills. And it's not obvious to companies whether those new skills are available. So it's the task of the education system in a country to produce those skills, which, however, they must reflect what companies need. So it's a game, an interactive game between skill production and skill utilization. But again, it is central that in this process, companies, the private sector, determine their innovation strategies, having in mind what skills will be available. Again, this is a learning process for which there is no obvious predetermined blueprint, but what can be introduced in a system is evaluation mechanisms that upgrade the quality of skills that need to be put in place. This relates, final point on the skills, this relates both to the young who are entering the labor market, but also to the elderly who are in the labor market and may risk being pushed out of the labor market because of their skills which are not useful anymore. So how can that be addressed? There is a potential for senior workers to be looking at education and training in ways that also makes them valuable for themselves, but also for the companies. And so this is to say that skill strategy have to encompass the full spectrum of age brackets in the skill stock. My final point is that all of this and other things require a reform of the state. This is what the subtitle of this report says. And as I mentioned already, having a more efficient state is essential to make reforms work in the longer term. Here, OECD has developed an increasingly ample experience and evidence of what that means in practice. But first of all, before I go into some detail, let me recall the main principles of having a good reform of the state. First of all, there must be a strategic vision of the government. What is the government wanting to do in the long term? Second, irrespective of the fact that states may have decentralized levels, there must be, in any case, a strong center of government to steer and implement strategies and public policies. Who and how does things in the government? And in so doing, it is important to also have what I would call an ownership process, meaning that society must be involved in this process of government setting up strategy and priorities over the long term. Last but not least, all this requires upgrading the quality of public administration, which means building integrity and transparency, but also using a workforce which is motivated and therefore is willing and able to deliver. Now, if you apply those principles to the case of Portugal, again, this is discussed in the report, we notice that trust in government is not very high, and it's actually been decreasing. So this is a major challenge there. But at the same time, we find out that levels of trust vary by institution. For instance, public services fare better in terms of trust than political institutions. This speaks to the point I already mentioned a couple of times, that speaks to the quality and composition of the big task of fiscal consolidation. There is a lot of scope to improve the quality and composition of fiscal consolidation in Portugal and in many other countries, but this requires a state that works to do that. So the two things, reforming the state and improving the quality of fiscal consolidation, go together. And they actually must be seen as two elements of one strategy. Let me state the obvious. If spending needs to be cut, when a decision is made of cutting some public spending, a decision is made of getting rid of some components of public administration that are providing services. So the question is a country prepared to give up those services because of cuts? But more importantly, how can those services be provided in spite of the fact that there is a savings? Is that possible? The answer is yes. Again, there is increasing evidence that we have collected that in areas such as employment support, education, healthcare, there are significant rooms of maneuver for improving the quality of public spending, which means either providing the same amount of services with the fewer resources, therefore you can cut the budget but provide the same amount of services to the citizens, or providing for a given amount of resources at more efficient services. So this is an efficiency search exercise in the state, which implies that the state is able to implement more efficient production of services for a given budget. To continue in Portugal, of course, as you know, the state is highly centralized in terms of revenues and expenditures, but at the same time, regional disparities remain wide. So we think that there is room for improvement there. So to conclude, spend the last couple of minutes, what are, according to this report, priorities for Portugal in reforming the state? Restore trust, strengthen the strategic decision-making, improve service quality, and open up to society in looking at innovative solutions, including in public administration. And there are a number of measures that I will not list now, how to these specific points can be achieved to restore trust, to look at enhancing the center strategic function, to improve fiscal management, and to maintain the quality of public services, including what to do in terms of improving the quality of the public service workforce, the personnel that is that's employed in the state. Here, just to state the obvious, there is scope for improving strategic planning in human resources management in the state, and also there is scope for integrating technology. In other words, innovation is something which is good for the private sector and companies, but it's also very good for the public sector. Again, this is stating the obvious, but if you have a strong vision of the government, if you have a goal to increase efficiency, then you can benefit much more than in the past from innovation in a number of ways. And certainly, these are points that are hinted at in this report, but let me finish, if I may, with an advertisement. The OECD stands ready to provide more detailed advice, if needed, in all the areas I've touched upon, bringing to bear the expertise we have in all the directorates that make up the OECD, and which we bring together in an integrated framework. So thank you very much for your attention.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Pierre Carlo Padoan, por esta apresentação, quer do relatório, quer daquilo que são as questões estruturais que entende que se colocam, quer num plano mais amplo, quer especificamente no caso português, designadamente as condições de conjugar uma visão a médio prazo de reforma de Estado com a aposta na qualificação e com uma estratégia de crescimento económico e o envolvimento que é necessário, quer do setor público, quer da sociedade, num sentido mais amplo, e a importância que aspectos como a formação e a educação têm nesta, neste caminho de reforma de Estado. São aspectos que o Parlamento, quer nas suas várias comissões, tem refletido, mas esta visão que a OCDE nos traz é aqui muito importante para a reflexão e para o debate que nós temos de fazer. Eu iria passar desde já a palavra aos colegas. Eu sugeria até que pudéssemos ter várias inscrições e depois o Sr. Pierre Carlos Padoan responderia em conjunto. Não estou a dizer que não possa haver uma segunda ronda, mas para já, aqueles que se quisessem inscrever, Sra. Deputada Maria Antónia Almeida Santos, o Deputado Duarte Pacheco, depois tomarei nota de outros pedidos. Sra. Deputada Maria Antónia Almeida Santos é eleita pelo Partido Socialista, que posso também, para além de ser Presidente da Comissão de Saúde, qualquer um.
Muito obrigada. Eu começo por cumprimentar e é um prazer estar aqui na presença tanto do Sr. Embaixador como do Sr. Secretário-Geral Adjunto da OCDE. Eu aqui na minha dupla qualidade de Presidente da Comissão Parlamentar de Saúde e de deputada do Grupo Parlamentar do Partido Socialista, li, embora não atentamente, o relatório, mas percebi, e da apresentação que desde já agradeço, que tivemos desde logo uma boa notícia em que nos diz que Portugal já fez muito. Mas também temos uma má notícia que Portugal tem que fazer mais e que necessitamos de um clima de confiança. E aqui é que surge o problema. E como deputada que tenho estado atenta a tudo o que se tem passado em Portugal e a esta tentativa de reformar, de fazer uma reforma estrutural que melhore a situação dos portugueses, tenho algum ceticismo em relação às respostas da economia portuguesa e as consequências sociais das políticas que têm sido seguidas, das políticas de austeridade e, em particular, do corte de rendimentos, mais grave, como sabem, na questão dos pensionistas. E, portanto, uma constatação é que esta política, esta tentativa de reforma, já produziu muitas vítimas em Portugal. Falou nisso e muito bem, na questão do desemprego jovem, que eu penso que é um dos maiores problemas com que Portugal se confronta. E, portanto, mais desestruturação das relações laborais só agrava a economia portuguesa, que, a meu ver, já esgotou toda a flexibilidade que tinha para mais baixas salariais. Portanto, eu penso que é importante destacar do relatório a recomendação, digamos assim, de maior investimento público, por exemplo, em setores-chave como os portos, as ferrovias, bem como nas políticas que apostam nas qualificações. Penso que deram grande destaque às qualificações, concordamos plenamente. E mais importante, é muito importante, por exemplo, falar na educação de adultos, que infelizmente em Portugal, nos últimos anos, sofreu um retrocesso. Portanto, retomar esse caminho das qualificações seria um caminho que, a meu ver, e que pelos vistos, na opinião do relatório da OCDE, também seria um caminho a seguir. Mais qualificações, mais inovação e a escolha de setores-chave. Por exemplo, a energia, que já demonstrou ser um setor que traz vantagens. Já na área da educação e da saúde, a sua opinião, eu penso que é importante mobilizar a sociedade, haver um combate ao desperdício, por exemplo, na área da saúde, não alterando a qualidade e o acesso dos portugueses aos cuidados de saúde, mas infelizmente, e aqui falo um pouco do reflexo que tenho tido enquanto Presidente da Comissão Parlamentar de Saúde, o acesso aos cuidados de saúde dos portugueses não tem melhorado. E não tem melhorado numa questão que também aqui falou, não em termos de saúde, mas em termos gerais, que é a questão da equidade. Com estas medidas criaram-se discriminações que são hoje patentes. O aumento das taxas moderadoras fez com que nem todos os portugueses possam ter acesso aos cuidados de saúde. Muitas vezes, as taxas moderadoras, que evidentemente não servem para financiar, mas sim para moderar o uso, serviram e, em muitos casos, tornaram-se taxas impeditivas do acesso. E isso é que não pode ser. Há uma inversão total da filosofia subjacente até à nossa lei fundamental, que é a Constituição da República. Portanto, em termos de saúde, o que eu penso, e bem, que se deve combater o desperdício, mobilizar a sociedade, tentar com que a comunidade possa ter o seu contributo ativo e colaborar, mas muitas vezes a despesa em saúde torna-se um investimento que mais tarde vai se tornar uma poupança. Portanto, concordar com parte do relatório, mas mantenho a minha preocupação relativamente aos cortes e gostava, se fosse possível, que me indicasse mais exemplos, principalmente na área da saúde e da educação, que pudessem, de alguma forma, inverter esta curva descendente do acesso e do cuidado dos portugueses aos cuidados da saúde e da educação, que é o que, infelizmente, temos estado a assistir. Muito obrigada.
Muito obrigado, Sra. Deputada. Eu passaria agora a palavra ao Sr. Deputado Duarte Pacheco, que é o coordenador dos deputados do Partido Social Democrata, o maior partido da coligação do Governo, na Comissão de Orçamento, Finanças e Administração Pública.
Muito obrigado, Senhor Presidente, Srs. Deputados. Partilho as boas-vindas que o Sr. Presidente e a minha colega endereçaram ao Sr. Secretário-Geral Adjunto e ao Sr. Embaixador e agradecer a exposição que aqui foi feita. Numa curta intervenção, dizer duas coisas e deixar uma pergunta. Por um lado, saudar o relatório que é feito, um relatório profundo, que faz um diagnóstico que nós partilhamos. A crise internacional de 2008, que nos afetou, não é responsável pela crise que vivemos, pois foi à vista de todas as debilidades estruturais que o país tinha. E que são evidentes na primeira década do século atual, em que depois de 10 anos nós assistimos a um crescimento médio de 0,3, a um crescimento progressivo do desemprego, a uma perca progressiva da competitividade, a um aumento paulatino da despesa pública e, consequentemente, a um aumento paulatino da dívida pública. E, portanto, não é um efeito de 2 anos, nem de 3, foi todo um problema estrutural do nosso país que a crise internacional e que a crise financeira puseram à luz. Mas o problema já cá estava e, portanto, se não fosse a crise internacional, poderíamos ter continuado naquele caminho mais uns anos, se calhar agora estávamos em 2011, já com os problemas mais visíveis. Mas essa parte do diagnóstico que nós partilhamos tem sido aquilo que nós temos vindo a dizer. Segundo, o relatório evidencia aquilo que é a dificuldade com que o governo português e o país se debate, que é, num curto espaço de tempo, necessitar de fazer tudo em simultâneo. Nomeadamente, a reforma da administração pública, a reforma estrutural da nossa economia e promover a coesão económica e social. E isto parece quase que impossível. Num curto espaço de tempo, 2, 3, 4 anos, conseguir resolver problemas estruturais da nossa economia, simultaneamente a reforma do Estado e salvaguardar a coesão económica e social. E, portanto, só mostra quanto difícil é a tarefa com que o país está confrontado. E, Sr. Secretário-Geral, Sr. Embaixador, penso que deverão, como observadores atentos à realidade portuguesa, constatar a grande resiliência da sociedade portuguesa e dos portugueses, que têm aguentado estas dificuldades e estas reformas, compreendendo aquilo que tem que ser feito e mostrando grande disponibilidade para as aceitar. Mas nós estamos neste momento no fio da navalha. porque a questão que existe neste momento, findo 2 anos e meio, 2 anos e 3 meses, de aplicação de um programa intenso de reformas, é se qualquer hesitação pode perigar, pode fazer cair tudo o que já foi feito. Nomeadamente, eu gostava que salientasse qual é a importância, como observador, do consenso político e do consenso social para o desenvolvimento destas reformas. E se o ideal é alcançar 100 a qualquer custo, ou se porventura pode ser preferível alcançar 80 com uma compreensão política e social que ajuda que os 80 sejam verdadeiramente alcançados. Porque, disse bem, e o nosso país mostrou que é um, senhor Secretário-Geral, que é um observador que compreendeu bem a realidade portuguesa. Nós somos muito bons a fazer legislação. Nós somos, por vezes, temos em muitas áreas a legislação da melhor da Europa. Somos muito inovadores, para utilizar uma expressão. Nem sempre depois somos tão eficazes na implementação. E, portanto, nós podemos alterar todas as leis, alterar todas as regras, que sejam, teoricamente, as mais adequadas para a resolução dos nossos problemas. Mas depois temos que ter a força política e o consenso social para as aplicar. E gostava de o ouvir na dicotomia sobre esta matéria. Finalmente, eu gostava de subscrever aquilo que fez referência, que as reformas estruturais, os resultados não são no dia a seguir. Demoram algum tempo a que sejam percepcionados pela sociedade. Nós estamos em setembro de 2013 e os dados do segundo trimestre deste ano evidenciam alguns sinais positivos para a economia portuguesa. Na produção industrial, no crescimento do PIB, na diminuição do desemprego, no aumento das exportações e no aumento da cota de mercado. Mas são sinais muito tímidos e não podemos desde já fazer nenhuma festa, desculpem a minha expressão, porque percebemos que precisamente como são tímidos, a qualquer momento podem dissipar-se e retomarmos a rota em que estávamos. Desejamos e estamos a trabalhar para que se confirmem, mas são tímidos. Mas se por um lado, na sua opinião, não podem ser desde já resultado das reformas estruturais, nomeadamente no mercado laboral, no mercado da concorrência, no mercado do licenciamento, no mercado da habitação, na própria justiça, cujas, só para dar alguns exemplos, diárias, onde essas reformas, de acordo com o memorando de entendimento, têm vindo a ser desenvolvidas. E, finalmente, partilhar uma preocupação, que é os altos custos da energia, e em Portugal, e quanto isso afeta também a competitividade da nossa economia. E isso também, se pudesse desenvolver um pouco mais sobre o tema, tenho a certeza que todos os portugueses ficavam agradecidos. Muito obrigado.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Deputado Duarte Pacheco. Algum dos colegas pretende intervir nesta fase? Não, eu acrescentaria apenas se me permitem, apenas uma questão breve, mas que tem muito a ver com aquilo que são os dramas em Portugal e em toda a Europa neste tempo. E que a visão de médio prazo da OCDE é aqui, uma visão estrutural, é aqui muito importante. A Europa, nos últimos anos, respondeu em regra de forma pouco articulada e normalmente tardiamente àquilo que são os efeitos, quer globalmente na zona euro, quer na solidez do próprio projeto europeu, quer em cada um dos países, àquilo que são os efeitos da crise económica internacional, bom, iniciada como referência em 2008 com a falência do Lehman Brothers e tudo aquilo que, a partir daí, nestes 5 anos, tem ocorrido na economia internacional e designadamente na economia europeia. E nós tivemos aqui, diria que, uma primeira fase em que a prioridade absoluta foi atribuída a estratégias de austeridade. Estratégias em que a prioridade indiscutível era o objetivo de consolidação fiscal. Isso levou, quando outros países da OCDE estão já num claro caminho de recuperação económica, os Estados Unidos, que adotou uma via diferente, com incentivos, quer da Reserva Federal, quer incentivos de investimento público à economia, que permitiu aos Estados Unidos entrar mais cedo num caminho de crescimento, quando o próprio Japão, timidamente, parece voltar a um caminho de crescimento. Quando economias emergentes da OCDE estão em franco crescimento, o México e o Chile são hoje na OCDE quase vistos como novos casos de sucesso entre os países membros deste clube muito especial de economias desenvolvidas, que é a OCDE. A Europa conseguiu, em 2013, começar o ano com uma recessão global. E mesmo países que eram referências de ortodoxia financeira, como a Finlândia ou a Holanda, a Finlândia e a Holanda, que tanto exigiam a países do Sul, designadamente a Portugal, ou à sua Itália, de disciplina financeira, a Holanda e a Finlândia estavam em recessão no início deste ano. Bom, a questão é uma questão muito geral, é, neste momento, como é que é indispensável conjugar uma estratégia a médio prazo de solidez das contas públicas com uma estratégia que crie confiança. Crie confiança nas empresas, crie confiança nas pessoas e que permita reforçar a competitividade e que permita, de facto, promover o crescimento e o emprego. Bom, hoje o caminho, hoje parece que a Europa está no início de uma lenta recuperação. A dúvida que temos em Portugal, é se o acentuar de medidas restritivas não pode em Portugal ter um efeito que nos leva a um quarto ano de recessão da economia, e, de algum modo, Portugal ficar de fora nesta fase decisiva de viragem do ciclo económico europeu, Portugal ficar com custos pesados de fora desta inversão de ciclo que todos desejamos para a Europa, mas que para nós, permitam-nos, é fundamental que Portugal também acompanhe. Mas dava a palavra, mais do que o debate interno continuará certamente, mas hoje queremos sobretudo ouvir o Sr. Padoan.
Well, thank you very much for these questions. Let me just say at the outset that I'm not going to answer all of them because I don't have the answers to all of your questions, but let me pick some of those. The chair of the ELT committee said many important things, but also asked me for examples on how to improve healthcare and education. I am not very, very prepared on specific recommendations on healthcare and education in the case of Portugal. But what I can tell you is that as far as healthcare is concerned, well, there are a number of elements which should be brought in, and perhaps you can tell me if they fit also in the case of Portugal. First of all, there is no one-size-fits-all health model. We have not found one blueprint to suggest to any country that works better than others. So the issue is how each country puts together the pieces of the system. Second, that, of course, healthcare is highly reliant on technological progress and innovation. But this bears the problem of making it more expensive, not less expensive, because productivity in healthcare can be improved, but as aging comes, there are limits to that. Having said that, I think you mentioned in particular the one fiscal aspect, which is to say raising private sector fees for access to treatment and to medicines, of course, as a discriminatory component in vis-a-vis the poorest, and I fully agree with that. Here, there are ways, but I apologize, I don't have more specific examples, to discriminate consumption of treatment according to income. So this has to be done on a very specific case, but in the cases we have seen, that is also possible. I'll be more than happy to let you have the reports. We came out with a very big report last year on health systems across the OECD spectrum. So hopefully that is, and again, apologies for not being more specific. On education, well, here we have found consistently in many countries we've looked at in the education system, ranging from the US down to emerging economies outside the OECD, that usually secondary education is very inefficiently delivered. So this has to do, with some exceptions, this has to do with the fact that there's still failure to grasp the idea that producing skills, not so much at the higher education where you go into university and postgraduate, but secondary education and even primary education, there is failure to grasp the idea that producing skills for the very young is just a difficult problem as producing skills for the postgraduate people. So there is a problem of efficiency, which has to do with how you design incentives for teachers, how you design the optimal, quote-unquote, optimal size of a classroom, how you design the optimal size of a school and what kind of services that school should provide, exploiting IT, exploiting digital system. Again, I'd be more than happy to let you have reports on that. But those are contrary to the case of health. In the case of education, it is possible to identify some basic principles. One basic principle, which is now emerging, and here I hesitate to say it more because we don't have that strong an evidence, but this seems to be, in looking at this, what I call the skills strategy, meaning how can you produce skills for the future, one clear case comes to mind that you have to have a clear idea of the whole education life, not just a primary, not just a secondary, not just, and they are connected. So how do you increase the efficiency across the different steps? Efficiency does not mean that you decide at time zero what this young kid or young girl will do, but rather doing the opposite. How can you make that young girl and young kid be able to choose as he moves through his or her education curriculum to possibly change and adapt? This, of course, implies that you have a flexible supply of teaching, and which means that you have to have better, more efficient, and better paid teachers. But this can be done probably with a smaller number of teachers in many cases. So there are a few basic principles. Again, apologies for not being more specific. On the other points raised by Mr. Pacheco, Dr. Pacheco, well, you put a number of big points on the table, and let me see how I can react. You hesitation, which is not just a dancing movement. Well, this is very important, because there is indeed the risk of wasting a huge effort in many cases. I'm not talking about Portugal here only. I'm talking about many cases. You have two fronts. Countries in so-called sensitive countries have two fronts in which they fight the battle. One is the fiscal consolidation, and the other is structural reform. In the case of fiscal consolidation, I am almost tempted to say there is a turning point. And the turning point is when debt begins to decline. It may be declining from a high level. That is not so important. What is important is that it stops growing and it starts descending. This is a problem, by the way, that all OECD and non-OECD countries are facing, starting from the United States, Japan, the United Kingdom. Their debt continues to go up. And in many euro area countries, including sensitive countries, there has been more effort than, say, in the UK or in the US in reaching the turning point. So Portugal, to be very specific, Portugal is much closer to the peak than the United States or Japan. But Japan is easy because they have debt of 230% of GDP. But UK, okay, UK, we're talking about a country that... So I know it's painful, but when you think that, well, in 1 year's time, you are at the point in which debt starts declining. This is a new world, because if it starts declining, you get benefits which are cumulative, because this impresses a confidence shock, positive confidence shock to markets. Risk assessment goes down, and you save on your interest bill, which facilitates the speed. Of course, this is nicely said this way. But this is how I would measure, I would address your initial point, hesitation. Now, the story is different in structural reforms. Because structural reforms are, don't misread me, it's a never-ending process. Exactly for the point you said, because it's about implementation. So you have to agree on a law and then ask the government, okay, you implement it. Government and different levels of government. And there, implementation is of the essence, monitoring is of the essence, having the conditions is of the essence. Let me give you the example which does not relate to Portugal, but relates to my country, Italy. The OECD has recently released, a few months ago, the report on Italy. And the report on Italy had two big chapters. One was what needs to be done in terms of new laws, and there you have the list of labor markets, product markets. But then the second chapter was, what do you need to do to implement the laws you already passed? And we found that the following items are impeding reforms implementation. The following parts are, first of all, inefficient government. Sounds familiar, right? Second, a judicial system that does not work and raises the cost of litigation immensely. You can measure that in terms of points of GDP. Just the judicial system. Third, corruption. So if you have those three elements, which have to do a lot with trust in the state, transparency, the same good law, say in labor markets, produces totally different results according to whether or not you fix corruption, the civil system, and public administration. So in that case, there is no, it's a, you know, you have to keep running, but you get results that are more visible because people, citizens, feel that they get better money, better results for their taxes they pay, basically, at the end of the day. The high cost of energy. Well, yes, the answer is, here it's easy. Yes, the cost of energy is one of the major inputs. Again, Portugal is one case. Again, my country, Italy, is one of the highest costs. When I moved to Paris from Rome and I got the first electricity bill, I said, wow, this is heaven. It costs so little with respect to what I pay in Rome. And then I realized that Italy is probably the highest energy cost in Europe. So it goes without saying that this is a major element. Final point. You made a very important point, which is a global flavor. The rest of the world, and I would translate it, the rest of the world grows more than the euro area. How's that? Well, for two reasons. One has to do, in my view, one has to do with the sequencing of policies that were put in place after the crisis started. And here the relationship with the U.S. is very clear. What the U.S. did was, first of all, to fix the financial system. They brought in huge amount of public resources, the so-called TARP, $700 billion. They used that to recapitalize the banks. The banks were viable again. The government made money on that. And then they looked at the fiscal. Now they have a big fiscal problem because their debt is growing. But they have a financial system which has put the economy in the conditions to grow again. In Europe, we have said, oh, what do we do first? Well, first let's do the fiscal. And now the fiscal situation in Europe, if you take the euro area, the fiscal situation in the euro area looks much better than the US. So, but the financial system in Europe is not fully repaired. This is one reason. The other reason is that the euro is a big region with lots of countries, with one currency and one central bank. And the consequence of that has been that in the crisis, the euro has produced more and not less fragmentation. It's going exactly in the opposite direction. Why is that? Well, because we, meaning we as a member of the Economist congregation, we did not see the problems. We thought that the problems of monetary union would be just fiscal. Now we know that's not the case. So we are now coping with the fact that we need to adjust the financial system, we need to restore growth, while at the same time changing the institutional structure and infrastructure of the euro area, notably the banking union, but not just the banking union. So, and on top of this third reason, historically, even before the crisis, the euro area potential growth was much lower than the US. So all of us Europeans, are putting on our back structural impediments to growth that were there 15, 20 years ago, in different intensity. And so the structural reforms now are looking not just at the crisis consequences, but at the backload of reforms that were not implemented when the time was good, but there was no pressure to adjust. I think I'm running out of time.
Muito obrigado. Thank you, Mr. Padoan, for these answers and this very interesting debate we had here. As we said, we are probably running out of time. We have other meetings in your agenda, I know, with the Prime Minister and with the Minister of Finance. But I would like to thank you on behalf of the Budget and Finance Committee from the Portuguese Parliament and from our colleagues from other committees which were also with us this afternoon for this quite interesting and very useful debate we had here. We certainly are going to take in consideration always the OECD look to the Portuguese economy. Our committee is very committed to participate in your parliamentary network, and we certainly are going to follow this debate at global level and also to bring it to the Portuguese Parliament debates. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.